Cool. Okay, so chapter 8, verse 1. The point of what we're saying is this. We do have such a high priest who sat down at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven. Now, we're stepping into the theological centerpiece of this exhortation here. Verse 1 of chapter 8 indicates that the writer is now drawing together what has come before in order to kind of progress his argument into new territory. It's kind of a consolidating verse of sorts. So this kind of begs the question of, well, what has he been saying? I kind of remember what Mikey sort of said the other day at Citywide, but what's going on here? Well, the writer has returned to the subject of Jesus as our better high priest. His main argument from chapter sort of 4, verse 14, all the way to 10, 25, concerns this big idea of the position of the Son, our high priest, in relation to the earthly sacrificial systems. That's kind of a cool title you can give it. And he unpacks this in all its multifaceted dimensions, as the writer here has started to cover Jesus as a better high priest in chapter 5, from a better order of priesthood in chapter 7, who now ministers in a better place and so establishes a better covenant. So we haven't really looked at any of that yet, so we will next week engage though. So perhaps the most important thing to see here and to just to get is that the writer has reached the climax of an important theological argument just back in chapter 7, 26 there, I'll read it. Such a high priest meets our needs, one who is holy, blameless, pure, set apart from sinners, exalted above the heavens. And you can imagine the kind of readers going, yes, we do need such a high priest. Well, he is one that is seated at the right hand of the throne in the throne of the majesty in heaven. And that was the point that was made back in 1:3 about the Son. So back in chapter 1, verse 3, we see the Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. After he provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. But now it's repeated, this verse, in direct application to the high priest theme. So our high priest, Jesus, now sits in the place of honour and privilege, not in Jerusalem, not on earth, but in heaven. So here our eyes are surprisingly turned upwards towards the place where he is. So when chapter 8, verse 1 kicks off in this way and states that we have this kind of priest, this type of priest, such a priest, we can assume that what kind of carries on next is the writer's justification for how Jesus, the better high priest, has kind of eclipsed what's come before. So with a bit of that kind of that background, let's look at verses 2 to 5, a better minister of the tabernacle. So what we see here is Jesus as high priest has a better is a better minister because of where he serves in the true tabernacle, that is the heavenly sanctuary. A comparison is sort of present here between ministering on earth and ministering in heaven. So let's have a look at the comparison going on here in verse 2. It kicks off with where Jesus serves. So that's the true tabernacle compared to the Leviticus priesthood, which serves in the old tabernacle. So, the tabernacle. Well, that's not something that's kind of on display in a carpet shop, or that you would find on a sewing website, or even that you might see in your flatmate's house. You know, oh, that's a nice tabernacle you've got there. Let's just get some background here as to what the tabernacle is to kind of get the significance. So the tabernacle was a large tent that was pitched in the middle of the Israelite camp. The tabernacle was kind of constructed just after Israel was rescued out of the land of Egypt, and it was in use until the temple replaced it when Israel was established in the promised land of Canaan. And so the main overarching purpose of the tabernacle was to give expression to the divine human relationship that was at the center of the covenant Moses established between God and his people. So it gave expression to the covenant. So the tabernacle did this in a few ways. It represented God's dwelling, being present in the middle of the people, hence in the middle of the camp. The tent showed God's continuing presence and commitment to his people. It was a place of divine human communication. You know, the tent of meeting is another name for the tabernacle. And it's where you went to encounter God, right? And to commune with him. And thirdly there, it facilitated the maintenance of the covenant through the priesthood and the sacrificial system. So to keep approaching God, express your worship and love for him, to receive forgiveness for breaking the law and have that fractured relationship repaired, where did you go? Well, the tabernacle. The tabernacle was the only place that you could do that. So you can see how the tabernacle was central to Israel's life and worship. And you can draw a little bit more of a thread here, I think, as to why it was such a disaster, right, when it was destroyed, and why the rebuilding of the temple was just so important. You know, when they got back to the land, temple, build it, build it, build it, build it. Why? Well, because of its connection with the covenant. So the central function of the priesthood in that tabernacle was to bring gifts and sacrifices, and it was the central tenet of their responsibilities that you see there. So by definition, Jesus as a priest, he needed to bring a sacrifice, as you see there, to fulfill his role. But the problem is that Jesus couldn't have done that in the tabernacle pitched in the camp or the temple in Jerusalem, because he wasn't a priest according to the Levitical order. So he kind of wasn't from the right family line or heritage. So earlier in chapter 7, which we'll come to next week, we see that although Jesus is disqualified from the Levitical priesthood, there was a priest whose priesthood transcended the tabernacle and the Levitical order, and it's that priesthood to which Jesus belongs. But for the purpose of this passage here, we are supposed to see that Jesus couldn't fulfill the expectations of a priest of the Levitical tabernacle because it was impossible for him to sacrifice there, right? So hopefully we're getting a bit of idea of the tabernacle and its activities. But what about the true part here? Well, the true as opposed to what? Fake tabernacle? No, true in the sense of heavenly and permanent as opposed to earthly and passing. The reality, the kind of true state of affairs ideas as opposed to what it's like or kind of like, but not. The tabernacle, though, wasn't a pretend one, sort of a tent front for false practices. God did command it, as you see there, to be built in verse 5. And it had to be taken seriously and built exactly to the specifications. But the true tabernacle is established by God, not by people. So it isn't associated with this creation, but it's otherworldly. So perhaps it's kind of helpful to think of this along the lines of like a cubby house, right? Is a cubby house a house? Well, yes. Does it fill the function of a house? Mostly, you could sleep in it, right? You could study in it. But it's clearly not actually a house, nor does it intend to be, right? It doesn't replace a house. But in most senses, it is a house though, isn't it? And I think this is perhaps the kind of comparison between the earthly and the heavenly tabernacle is a little bit kind of like that. You see, the service of Jesus is better here because he reveals the reality, the actual tabernacle, and moves us into it. The location is different, better. The comparison here and before shows you and I how the Old Testament tabernacle was a shadowy outline of the heavenly model. That is why the tabernacle had to be accurate in its construction, because it is the picture of the true tabernacle. It was fashioned on the real state of affairs. A cubby house, like a house, in fact is a house. But it's not possible to say they're equal to each other, right? Jesus' ministry takes place at the very throne of the Majesty on High, the one true God, in the sanctuary, not the scale model that the Levitical priesthood was limited to. Jesus now, in these last days, inaugurates what the tabernacle was always pointing to and preparing his people for. And so this means that a seismic shift in the focal kind of point of Jewish worship has taken place, doesn't it? It renders the tabernacle that may have been functioning at the time of writing this letter as redundant. So a couple of thoughts in regard to the tabernacle here. Firstly, if you identify as a Jew or associate yourself with that kind of religious practice, the argument here could be a bit surprising, confronting even, but hopefully exciting. He doesn't say that your sanctuary and whatever your current equivalent might be wasn't important, but that it's come to its conclusion because it's given way to your new tabernacle. And this is what you've been hoping for, right? And that what the prophets were prophesying about. So don't fear its absence or its destruction, as you can now have its reality. And it's accessible through the priest of Jesus, Messiah. And he's the minister that you now need. So for the Jew, the Jewish Christian back then, as well as now, or many of you guys who are Gentiles with no Jewish heritage or background, don't drift back to this old tabernacle. You see, outside of the New Testament tabernacle, well, where else is there to go? Don't look to and be drawn back to the protection, the continuance, or the re-establishment of the scale model, if you like. Instead, set your sights on and hold tight to the reality and the one who ministers there. Don't be put off that there isn't a physical sanctuary with elaborate ceremonies and beautiful rituals in ornate buildings. Don't be worried that this isn't a feature of our faith. Doesn't mean that anything is kind of lacking or being overlooked in your devotion. And if you do see yourself linked with a religion that involves temples, or you guys might know some who are, then let me encourage you and encourage your friends to come to the true temple, this tabernacle. This is where you'll find the one true living deity that you seek. It's here. And secondly, another thought is be wary, Unifellowship, of churches and conferences and kind of special meetings that intentionally intentionally make you dependent on their physical location for you to meet with God and perform your worship, okay? When a church suggests that this is the place you meet with God, I think the reality before us here helps us see that this is a slide back to copy and shadow. It's kind of like cubby housing, if you like. The place where our gifts and our offerings, it's our lives, are brought before God is not a building of bricks and mortar, but the heavenly home of our eternal God. Be wary of thinking that places too much emphasis on the earthly, is too grounded in here. Remember that we pray our Father in heaven. Jesus meets with God on our behalf in heaven, and that is the focal point of our worship. It is biblically unhelpful and it's theologically misleading to call a gathering space the sanctuary. Whether it's written over the door as you walk in, or there's a designated space at the front of the building. To operate like this is to misunderstand that we now have the true tabernacle with a better servant in it. The previous tabernacle with its priesthood is gone, and the church, in this way in Hebrews, doesn't serve to replace it, nor do I think it represents it. I don't want a merely Christianized earthly tabernacle. I want a heavenly one. So secondly, a minister of a better covenant. Verses 6 to 13. Let me read those to you. Or the first few verses. But the ministry Jesus has received is as superior to theirs as the covenant of which he is mediator is superior to the old one and is founded on better promises. For if there had been nothing wrong with that first covenant, no place would have been sought for another. But God, finding fault with the people, has said. We'll pick up the rest in a moment. So we see Jesus is a superior priest or minister because of where he ministers in the true tabernacle. It's this superior ministry that means in the next part of this chapter, Jesus mediates a new covenant built on better promises that replace the old, and therefore it's better. So verse 6 says, but the ministry Jesus has received is as superior to theirs as the covenant which he is a mediator is superior to the old one and is founded on better promises. So the writer here moves from talking about service in the tabernacle and then the seemingly kind of no-brainer logical thought progression being the topic of the covenant. So what is the connection here? Let's just take another step back and think about what a covenant is. We thought about a tabernacle. Now let's think about the covenant. So one way of understanding the covenant is that it's a solemn commitment guaranteeing promises or obligations undertaken by one or both covenanting parties. So it's kind of like a binding agreement or contract into which provides a basis for interaction between its parties. So it's like marriage vows, right? That's a form of covenant. I don't know, signing up to engage is kind of like a covenant, but not really, but you should sign up. Covenant with it. So the covenant in mind here is the one that was established at Sinai. It was at that mountain, again, that time after God had rescued Israel from Egypt, where God spoke and he gave the law with all its precepts and practices. And the Ten Commandments was, of course, the centerpiece, wasn't it? That was the heart of the covenant, if you like. And the original covenant now the old, as the writer puts it here, was mediated by Moses. So to give you an idea, in Exodus 24, it says, when Moses went and told the people all the Lord's words and laws, they responded with one voice. Everything the Lord has said, we will do. Moses then wrote down everything the Lord had said. He got up early the next morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and set up 12 stone pillars representing the 12 tribes of Israel. Then he sent young Israelite men, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as fellowship offerings to the Lord. Moses took half the blood and put it in bowls, and the other he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it to the people. They responded with, we will do everything the Lord has said, we will obey. Moses then took the blood, sprinkled it on the people and said, this is the blood of the covenant the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. So it was the covenant that underpinned God's relationship with Israel. Okay, it was the covenant that underpinned God's relationship with Israel. And it set the parameters for their special relationship, a people and their God. And this is why it's one of the most important features throughout the whole Bible and why we keep coming back to it. The covenant is all about how God and Israel would come into and continue in a relationship with each other. The way a sinful people and a holy God, the creator and the creature, the divine and the human, can relate rightly. And it's also important to know that, in essence, the covenant here spells out the type of nation that the Lord intended Israel to be. The goal of it was to establish a special nation through which the Lord would make himself known, his character and glory, to all the families of the earth. And it was given to facilitate the fulfillment of the covenant to Abraham back in chapter 12. So that's just an interesting connection, is that that's how that covenant continues and doesn't clash with the new one. So this is what is going on as we read in Exodus 19. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you'll be my treasured possessions. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites. And it is this covenant that keeps coming up and again throughout the Old Testament. So, in the book of Exodus, what is located in the middle section all about the inauguration of the covenant? Well, it's the instructions about the tabernacle. We see the tabernacle is intimately and intrinsically tied to the covenant. You can actually only understand the tabernacle in relation to the covenant, and the tabernacle only makes sense and serves its function if it's there to give expression to the covenant. Do you get that connection? They're interdependent. So why the apparent kind of no-brainer move here in the argument to a better covenant? Well, because we've just come from a better minister in the true tabernacle. There then has to be a new covenant afoot. The new, the true tabernacle couldn't compute with the old covenant, couldn't it? It doesn't mesh. The heavenly sanctuary must be intertwined with something different, something better. It's got to facilitate something new. And it's the service of Jesus as the superior minister that is qualified to bring or mediate this new covenant as a gracious gift. So let's move on to verse 7-8 and consider that old and new covenant. The focus of the rest of the passage is on this better covenant. And this is based on better promises. The reason for the new covenant enacted on better promises is because what we see there in verse 7 and 8, God found fault with the people. If there had been nothing wrong with the first covenant, no place would have been sought for another, but God found fault with the people and said, we'll read that in a second. This unavoidable roadblock that has at its root a broken relationship with God couldn't be overcome either by the Levitical priesthood or their ministry. Jeremiah saw this problem too, and that's why the prophecy that he brought is quoted here. So Jeremiah, of course, is a prophet in the Old Testament around the time of the kings, and he was prophesying mainly to the southern kingdom of Judea that was in the messy time of being conquered, its people exiled heartbreakingly as a result of their disobedience and their inability to keep God's law. It kept breaking the covenant. The hope of this changing is then held out in an unprecedented way. So God says through Jeremiah that the time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their forefathers when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they did not remain faithful to the covenant and I turned away from them, declares the Lord. This is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I'll put my laws in their minds and write them on their heart. I'll be their God and they'll be my people. No longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother, saying, know the Lord, because they will all know me from the least of them to the greatest, for I will forgive their wickedness and remember their sins no more. This new covenant will address the problem of disobedience and rebellion in three ways. So first, look down at verse 10, implanting God's laws in people's hearts. I'll put my laws in their minds and write it on their hearts. The significance of this is that the Lord himself will bring his word to bear on their hearts. The law would be internalized, not external, not just God's ways known and then turned from. An obedience from the heart is assured because God has promised it. The reality that should have always been the case under the old covenant is now going to be experienced. That age-old cycle, you remember, of losing interest and petering off could finally cease. And that's astonishing. And second, verse 11, the knowledge of God as a matter of personal experience. No longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother, saying, know the Lord, because they'll all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. Previously, Israel knew God because he had revealed himself to them, as opposed to the nations around. So they did know something of God. But how well you knew God was fairly limited, though, and it was restricted mainly to the prophets, the priests, and the kings, right? The significance here is that all will know him personally and directly. An intimacy with God will be available for all people, unrestricted. Wow. And then verse 12, sins totally forgiven and forgotten, for I'll forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more. And this here marks the climax of the new covenant, as it is this that makes everything else possible. Sure, sins were forgiven before and some provision was made for that. But under that old covenant, yet under the new, it's unqualified, isn't it? And it's open-ended forgiveness. That's what's astonishing here. There would be no more annual, seasonal, monthly, or daily reminders of sin like under the old sacrificial system. That's what's amazing. And then the goal of the covenant remains the same. I will be their God and they will be my people, back in verse 10 there. It underpins the unique relationship that God and his people are to share, isn't it? The same reason. And these are better promises that overcome the fault of the people, right? We are not just looking at a rehash, an upgrade, or a refreshing of the covenant, but a radically new one. It is one where God's relationship with his people will be firmly, intimately, and securely established in a way and at a level never known throughout the history of Israel. What is utterly amazing is that the covenant God is bringing in stating, cannot be broken. And this is what God in his covenant relationship wanted all along, and he's kept pursuing, isn't it? It is the better ministry of Jesus in the true tabernacle that has guaranteed this. Here we see the astonishing commitment of God to assure us, to secure that we can and that we will rightly relate to him. The writer of the Hebrews shows his readers and you and I that to belong to the new covenant, you're a new covenant Christian, it assures you that you won't drop out from being a Christian. You might drop back a bit, sure, but you won't drop off. The better covenant, it doesn't allow for it. It gives no space for it. Surely overcoming this is exactly the point it was made for, right? So be comforted in your concerns there or your fears. You see, as we step back and weave the argument together here, what we see from chapter 7, and we'll see, is a heavenly and permanent order of priesthood for a heavenly and permanent tabernacle, for a heavenly and permanent offering, for a new covenant that establishes a heavenly and permanent salvation. And look at how good this is. Unifellowship. Look at how good we've got it compared to the old covenant. Life under the new covenant is just so much better. So don't go back and don't give up. Don't take on anything else. You're a new covenant person. We enjoy the reality and we partake in the new. Previously, it was copy and shadow and a covenant that highlighted faults and limited knowledge of God and had to keep up with dealing with sin. Not anymore. This is great. And if you don't identify as a Christian, then also just look at how good this is. At the center of God's message is this type of agreement, if you like. And isn't this something worth accepting or at least figuring out more? Why not take it up as yours? Accept Jesus and receive the gracious gift of this covenant. Where else do you have to go? So a couple of quick reflections before I wrap up. Just want to throw back as we consider this kind of whole chapter here. What we looked at in our lunchtime session, are Christians inconsistent in their use of the Old Testament? It's worth noting that this chapter gives you, I think, kind of an easy in to do hermeneutics well. That is, read the text of the Bible to arrive at the faithful and truthful understanding and meaning. So use this passage, I think, for this. Considering our passage before us, the writer, on a simple but important level, is just showing us how the Old and the New Testament make sense, isn't he? He names what continues and what doesn't. The continuance and discontinuance of the Old and New Testament. That first half of the Bible and that second half of the Bible. See how the Old Testament here is being linked to and understood in relation to the new. A helpful thing that we get from this is that we see here that the New Testament always sends us back to the Old Testament, right? And then the Old Testament sends us back to the new in order to understand it. That's what's going on here. They complement and they complete one another and so speak and interpret each other, yeah? So how does something like the tabernacle or the covenant make sense for a Christian today? Well, these few verses just teach us that the writer of the Hebrews comes to the Old Testament Christologically. That is, centered on and understood in relation to Jesus Christ, his person and his work, Christologically. So let's do likewise, yeah? The Bible invites you and I to read and think about it in a certain way with certain perimeters. So let's follow those and stick within that. Whether you identify as a Christian or you're kind of a happy observer, you will only make sense of this part, the first half with the second part, if you tether it to Christ, okay? Otherwise, you'll find Christians, or you Christian, will find yourself inconsistent in the use of the Old Testament. And as you look into the Christian message, or you hear a Christian talking about it, again, whether you're a Christian or not, keep asking, keep seeking to get its meaning in relation to Jesus. Cut into kind of my waffle or others' waffle by saying, hey, look, if you want to help me understand it from Jesus' perspective in light of his works and ways. So would you do that? Because that'll really help you if you do. The second quick thought is, I think this passage just helps us to approach the topic of the covenant, and also connected to this, lots of other topics, in a way that sees a continuance and a discontinuance. What carries on and what doesn't carry on. There can be a tendency, I think, to overemphasize one or the other by some people, and sometimes the denominations that we belong to when it comes to particularly this idea of covenant. So I think kind of a natural tendency perhaps of, say, the Presbyterian Church or the Reformed Church or the Anglican Church, their persuading can be to stress what carries on, how it keeps going. But the danger there can be that you end up basically dragging a lot of the old into the new, and you don't see that radical difference, and actually at that point you kind of just becomes a covenant renewal, right? Yet on the other hand, Baptists like myself, Charismatics or Pentecostals can sometimes stress the new so much that they kind of loose themselves off from the old, and they see the Old Testament as not really having any bearing or really any relevance whatsoever on the new. And so there can be a overemphasis on each party there. So bear that in mind as you hear people preach and teach, and you come to think about these things yourself. So we see here Jesus is a superior priest because of where he ministers in the true tabernacle. And it's this better ministry that means Jesus mediates the new covenant built on better promises that we enjoy. So verse 13 says, by calling this covenant new, he's made the first one obsolete, and what is obsolete and aging will soon disappear. So don't hold on to and go back to what is past its use-by date. Now, don't drink the out-of-date dirty milk from the fridge. Don't hook your telly up with analog. And don't look to the cubby house. Look instead to the heavenly and the permanent, the reality. Let me pray. Father God, we thank you that you have set Jesus up as our high priest, who is one that is able to minister with you in the true tabernacle, and so can bring about that new covenant so that we can relate to you rightly. And that's a really precious thing, and we ask that you would help us to continue to work that out in our life, and that you would increasingly make us new covenant people that hold to it, that grow into it, that love it more and more. Amen.